Okie dokie.
Please be so kind to pass the attendance sheet around. If you're in attendance, please check the sheet. You know, the Baal Shem Tov used to say, a person is where their thoughts are. Right? So that's what I meant. If you're in attendance, please check the sheet. If your mind is here also. Some bright spark is probably thinking, so I'll cut class, but I'll think I was here, right? But if you could telepathically check the sheet, okay. Fine. This class is in the Mesillas Yesharim. We'll be using this edition. No. You can get by on any edition. It just happens to be that the one that was printed by Ofek in Tavshin Nun Dal, 1994. That's the edition I use. It also has another version of Mesillas Yesharim that the Ramchal wrote but never published in his lifetime, which has it as a dialogue, set up as a dialogue between a Chacham and a Chassid, a wise man and righteous man. We'll be referring to the other version constantly on contrasting. Like I said, if you listen well and you take good notes, you can get by without it. It'll be easier if you had it. For today, I'd like to give an introduction to our author and tell you a little bit about his life. First, for fear that we may not get to it if we start telling his life story first, I'll tell you what's a little bit more well-known about him, what's a little bit more apparent from the books that he wrote. You know, you go to school, 12 grades. Right, then you go, how many more years of post-high school education, and then you're supposed to be able to tackle life. Doesn't make sense. Right? You know, your schooling is maximum 18 years of school. Right? You hope to live much longer than that. Right? So how can you possibly have enough information to handle life? With everything, technology changing and ideas changing, right? Ideas and technology changes faster than we can keep up. So what's the purpose of school? Right? It's futile. Right? Most of what they've taught you will be out of date by the time it comes time for application. Right? In truth, I once read an article where some educators advocate, dumping regular education as we know it, right, and just teaching people how to access information. Because whatever we're going to teach them is going to be passé by the time it comes time to use it. So just teach them how to download. Right? You get your diploma in downloading and you're set. Right. Right. So, what's the theory, behind education that, 12 some odd years of schooling, you're ready to take on life. It can't be called that you've accomplished all wisdom by that time. So what's the point? As much as you know, there's going to be 10 times more that you don't know. So I'll tell you what the theory ought to be. I can't promise that this is what's implemented, right? But the general idea is that no one thinks in their wildest imagination that they're going to be able to teach you in 12 years of school everything that there is to know. It's not possible. But there's a difference between details and principles. Right? The details are infinite and are constantly expanding. Right? But there's certain set principles that make up a basic framework of any discipline, right, that pretty much stays the same. Certain categories, right? Certain basic axioms. Now, when you have those straight, it's very easy to just add details afterwards because you have a framework it fits into very comfortably and very neatly. Like a doctor that went to medical school 20 years ago, right? So, of course, you know how far medicine's gone in the last 20 years? Well, he could still be a doctor, even though he hasn't been in school in 20 years, because he does hopefully go, you know, year in, year out to these conventions where they get supplementary teaching. Right? But even though at those conventions they don't drill him as nearly as hard as they drill kids in medical school, right? So how can you trust him? You know, he didn't have to face exams, right? He didn't have finals. How do you know you can trust him? He went to medical school 20 years ago. Right? So a doctor that just graduated, you could be sure he knows what he's talking about. You know, he's up with contemporary medicine. Right? The guy who went to medical school only 20 years ago, how do you know he won't kill you? All right, so the theory is, right, that since he once went to medical school and he has a certain framework, so it's very easy for him to quickly update his education, because he has a certain basic framework that everything could fit into quite comfortably, whereas when you originally drill someone in medical school, it's to give them the framework to begin with. Getting the hard part is to get the framework and to get the general principles. Once you have that straight, the details just fit. Right, before you have that framework, so every detail might seem like something very too abstract to relate to. But once you have that framework, you immediately recognize what the detail is addressing and where it fits and what it's being added to, what it complements. Right, that's supposed to be the theory of school. Right, so by now you should get it straight and understand what you were suffering for. But I can't promise you it's being implemented in a general school system. But Chazal insists, right, that this is the way it must be when learning Torah. Right. The mentor says that when Moshe Rabbeinu got Kol HaTorah Kula after 40 days and 40 nights in heaven, right? So, all right, 40 days and 40 nights—that's a long time. So that's 80 days, right, if you sleep at nights, right? I can't learn the whole Torah in 80 days, right? So Chazal are amazed, right? The Moshe Rabbeinu got called Torah Kula in 40 days and 40 nights, right? And Torah is, as Gemara says in Shavuos, Arucha Meret Mir, Rachal Miyam, Loida Esh Echa. You know, Chazal bring many, many psukim to prove that Torah is infinite. So how do you do it in 40 days and 40 nights? So Chazal say, you know, the pasuk says, "Va'iten o Moshe kechaloisoi ledaber ito." He told, gave Moshe when he finished speaking to him, kechaloisoi, when he finished speaking to him, as in kechaloso, as in bayechul, finished. So Rabbi Avo says like this in the Medrash, kechaloso miloshen klal, principles, klolim maser hakadosh baruch hu Moshe. What hakadosh baruch hu gave Moshe in 40 days and 40 nights are all the principles. The details of Torah are infinite, right? But Moshe Rabbeinu had the framework that holds all the infinite details. Right? The framework that holds the infinite details, that's doable. A person can master that. I mean, not in 40 days and 40 nights for mere mortal men, but a superhuman like Moshe Rabbeinu could get the framework of the entire Torah, the framework of all of Torah for all times, the framework that holds it all, he could get in 40 days and 40 nights. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him. Right, the principles. And this is what Chazal command us. Lo'olam yu divrei Torah b'yotcha klolim v'lo pratim. The way, the proper way to teach Torah is to teach principles, not details. Right? We take a look at how the Torah was handed down. It boggles the mind why so much information was left unwritten until relatively recent times. Yeah. Until they finally wrote the Mishnah. Right? And they were juggling all that Baal Peh, which makes you wonder how they did it. Right? Because the do's and don'ts of halacha are just massive. Right? And then when they finally wrote the Mishnah, there's not enough information in Mishnah to do one mitzvah right. There's just not enough information. Anyone's ever opened Mishnah, it's like, some very general halachas doesn't encompass, right, one mitzvah in its entirety. Right? So they wrote down the Mishnah, which is not a book that you could use for practical halacha. Right? Then they finally wrote the Gemara. You can't use that for practical halacha either. Right? So 1,000 years later, 1,000 years after the Gemara, they started writing halacha svar. So, which was 800 years ago. Right? And Torah was given almost 3,000 years ago. Right? What was going on? Right? What did people do this whole time? Right. So, the answer is, the way Torah was transmitted from generation to generation, right, was they passed on the principles. Right? And, because if you try to pass down the Torah in all its details, on that Chazal say, tafasta meruba lo tafasta. You want to have it all? You can't have it all. Right? Tafasta mua tafasta. Right? You have to make it short, you have to make it concise, and you have to rely on people that they will be able to, if you give them the framework, they'll be able to figure out the details for themselves. And that's the way the Torah was passed down. Obviously, in every generation, they had all these details, right? Because they had to keep the same mitzvahs we keep, right? But they felt that what has to be passed down to the next generation is not all the details, right? Because the next generation won't be able to encompass it. You make it too big and too detailed, you have nothing. They had sealed in on the principles. And that's, and that's also so they kept, and that's why it was able to be kept baal peh for centuries. So people had a hard time even keeping the principles baal peh. And that's when they wrote the Mishnah. But the Mishnah was to put the principles in writing. But the Mishnah is a book of principles. Right? Then there became a different problem. Right? And that is that people got weak on their ability to pull the details out of the principles. Right? The technology, the intellectual capacity to pull the details out of the principles and fit details into the principles, they got weak at. And that's what the Gemara is. Ravina and Rav Ashi gave us the Talmud. They did not give us a practical halacha book. They don't teach Talmud here. It's not a type of institution. Right, but, it's a book of thought. How to interpret the Mishnah, how to reconcile contradictions. It's a book on intellectual process. What was put in writing with the Talmud was not the details yet. Some of the details, many of the details, but not all the details. The main thing that what the Talmud was coming to give is the technology of how to pull the details out of the principles. Fit the details back into the principles. Right? And if once people have, as we call it in contemporary terms, the lumbus, right? They have that analytical ability, we don't have to write practical halacha books. They could figure it out themselves. Right? We just have to revive the people's ability to get the details out of the principles or associate the details back to the principles. 1,000 years later, right? Doesn't work. People's power to use the technology of the Talmud weaken. That's when they start writing practical halacha svarim because we fell even more. Right. Okay. Someone here, you have a question? Ma? As a little technai. Turn it on. And buy it. That's legal. No, do what you want. Oh, my weatherman. Come on. You want to open the windows? Oh, it's fine. It's a free country. What? Possible, yeah. Yeah. Not everybody can because not everyone is, willing to work hard enough. Right.
And how
is
the halacha passed down?
What?
How is the halacha practical halacha passed down?
No. there's no question, right, that people ask their fathers, how do I put on tefillin, how do I shake lulav, right? But it's amazing that what the generation committed to writing wasn't all those details. Right? What they committed to writing, they committed to writing, the principles. Because that's what has to be passed down, because it's the only way Torah could be preserved. You'll lose control of the Torah if you spell it out in all its details. You want to keep control of the system, you have to keep it in a certain concise framework, but that's a very deep thing. What an amazing work the Mishnah is. It's so concise, and what the Gemara sees in the Mishnah, what could be pulled out, and we're still working on it. We're still decoding the Mishnah, 2,000 years later almost. Right, we're still decoding the Mishnah. I mean, it's an amazing... Principles are not shallow. Principles are amazingly deep. You have to design the principle with the right words that it allude to, infinite details. Not everyone could write the Mishnah. Right? But then came the Ramchal, who did something just like that. Right? And that's when we come to our author. Right? The common thread of his intellectual genius that goes throughout his Sfarim, and he wrote Sfarim on numerous and diverse topics, right? Whether on Gemara, right? Whether on logic, he wrote a book on logic, he wrote a book on grammar, he wrote a book on eloquence, how to speak eloquently, right? Musar, Hashkafa, Kabbalah, there's a certain common thread to his genius that he was able to zero in on the essential system of things. Right. Just example. Everyone say, I've seen the set of Shas, about as big as the Encyclopedia Britannica. Roughly. Right. So he wrote a book about every type of move in logic the Gemara makes. Throughout, the entire Shas. Right? So it's a book about, this is the way Talmud thinks. How many pages in the book? Guess. What? What? 50. Close. 60. Right? And it's a book on every... the Gemara asks, in the hundreds of thousands of different types of questions. But all those questions fit into certain seven basic categories of logic that subdivide into such and such subcategories of logic. He was able to see, the essential system in the amazing mass of information. His book on logic, he says he read everything that there is to read on logic, that's what he attests to. Right. He read everything, what Jewish authors wrote and what secular authors wrote. He read everything. He read all books that were written on logic, and he lives, in the 1700s, so it was a lot written on logic by his time. And these are the rules of logical thought. How big is the book? Right? 60 pages. And that's everything. That's everything. That's what the Rambam wrote. That's what Aristotle wrote. That's everything. The details are many. How they prove their point is what's so expansive. He zeroed in on the essential system. The rest is just detail. His sefer called the Derech Hashem he attests to the fact that it is the Klolei Hamuna Va'Avoda, right? It is all the principles of that which we believe in and the dynamics of how divine service works. But it's also 100 pages. On the average, depending on how to print the printer. Right? And so he says something over there very, very interesting. Right? The Derech Hashem is deceptively simple. You know what the Derech Hashem is like? It's like Mishnayos. Right? A person says, hey, Mishnah, what's hard to understand? It's very easy. Right? Except when you realize that that every word is alluding to, an endless string of details, and Rabbeinu HaKadosh wrote it thinking on each word, I have to say it this way so people could infer and build on it 1,000 years later, such and such. Right? So Ramchal attests to the fact that that's how he wrote the Derech Hashem. This ends, we read these English translations of the Ramchal's books. Yeah. It's a joke. All right, he had testified. He thought about every single word. Right? And he warns the reader, I thought about every single word, and therefore you have to make every possible inference you can make. It's like Mishnah. Right? The Derech Hashem is very deceptively simple. You know, it's principles that allude to, you know, amazing Torahs, you know, particularly from the Zohar and the Ari. And he wrote it, and these are the principles. So that's the trend in all his books. That was a unique genius that he had, that the only one between him and Rabbeinu HaKadosh wrote the Mishnah that had, you know, that had this type of, you know, ability, you know, insight and ability to write it well, write up the principles well, was the Rambam. The Rambam's book is also, it's really Mishnah. The Rambam writes that himself. That's how he describes his Derech. He copied the Mishnah, his Mishnah Torah. That's why he called it Mishnah Torah. The book of principles. Right. That's why there's been Pirushim on the Rambam that are still being written. So, our author's genius is impressive when it comes to any field, but when it comes to the field of Kabbalah, it's indispensable. If not for the Ramchal, would have lost control. I mean, for those who learn Kabbalah, would have lost control over things like the Zohar and the Ari. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but just to give you an idea. The way the Zohar and the writings of the Ari are written, they're not written as normal textbooks. This is the beginning, this is the middle, the end, and this is the way it works. They're drushim. They're sermons. Right? It starts with a pasuk, and then they ask a question. Ask a question, pasuk, and they bring a proof. They bring a proof the other way. Right? They thrash out the issue. It's a dialectic. And then it ends, the reader gleans from the dialect, wherever he gleans, right? It's not set up as an orderly work, imparting information, right? It's a thought process, right? It's a thought process. And that's why sometimes on the surface there could be contradictions between one place in the Zohar and another place in the Zohar. One place in the Ari, another place in the Ari. It was written in a style very similar to that of the Gemara. Right? It's question, it's answer, it's question, answer. You could get lost in that. Now, they had to do it that way because they needed to prove their point. They had to prove the necessity of why they say what they say. That's why it had to be written in that style. That's why the questions, the answers, the proofs. So now you have to come and take that whole body of information that's not easy to understand and now set it up as principles and details. And that's what he did. You have to understand, before the Ramchal came on the scene, right, there was no such thing as learning Kabbalah in an orderly, pattern of, these are the basic axioms, these are what we build. It was all written as discourses. Right. Sermons, discourses, he made order. Right. This might sound a bit abstract, just letting you know. Right. So this is the unique genius of Ramchal. The Sefer Maseiros Yesharim is set up, in the same format that we described. He writes his introduction, he was looking for a framework. There's a certain framework, certain definite principles of what it means to become saintly, to become holy, to become a moral person, to attain prophecy, ultimately. Right? Kedusha, maybe de Ruach HaKodesh. That's how it ends off. Right. He was looking for a framework, and he said he found it. There's a brisa in Masechet Sefer Zohar, the famous passage of Pinchas Ben Yair, Torah maybe de Zehiris, Zehiris maybe de Zrizus, and those are the 11 steps. This is the framework. He said, I'm going to build on this. And I find that this brisa set up definite steps, definite principles. And that's the way, take a look, that's the way the book works. First he defines the principle. What is the Zehirus? Right? After that, he starts giving you the details. How can I Zehirus? After that, he does, now also practically, how do you acquire Zehirus? Right. So it's a very, very orderly work. You know, and it's the principles. You know, there may be many more details than what's actually written in this book, but any details you'll see in any Musar Sfarim ever written could all fit back into the framework described in this book. Okay. There's another, going back to the field of Kabbalah, there is another point about learning Kabbalah that our author made a tremendous contribution. Right. Now you're going to find, you know, in Zohar, in Ari, right, but even, you know, forget, you know, Zohar and Ari, even in Midrashim, right, there's a lot of things over there that need a lot of explaining, right? All right, God's divine throne, there are angels behind the throne, and all types of descriptions, you know. Yeah, God, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu saw God's fill-in. Famous, and we know God has no form. Right? What do all these things mean? Right? And well, you know what Yeshayo says he saw. He says he saw certain things. Right? What Yecheskel saw. That needs a lot of explaining, because we know God has no physical form. Even angels don't have a physical form. So what do they mean when they say they saw this, they saw that? Now, the Zohar and the Ari use the same terms that are used in the prophets and are used in the Agadahs, because all these words are really code words. Right? They are not to be interpreted in their physical meaning. They all have philosophical meanings. Right? There's a certain code that we have in our Torah. Right? It's called scientific notation. Right? You don't read these terms with a Hebrew-English dictionary. There's a philosophical dictionary which was kept Baal Peh, that was never committed to writing. Someone who started writing such a dictionary was the Rambam. The Rambam's first chelik of the Mor Nevuchim is a philosophical dictionary. But he admits that he's hiding more than what he's revealing. Right? The Rambam, the whole first section of the three parts of the Mor Nevuchim is a philosophical dictionary, where the Rambam explains what does it mean when the prophet said he saw God as a hand. What is Yad? What is Regel? Right? Etc. You take a look. That's how every perek starts. There's an entry. This word. And a philosophical meaning, a non-physical meaning to it. But like I said, the Rambam more explained what it doesn't mean as opposed to what it does mean. Because what it does mean belongs to the area that we call Sod, the secrets of the Torah. But you know, get this principle straight. The code that is in the prophets is the same code that's used by Chazal Yagadatas. It's the same code that's being used in the writings of the Zohar, and it's the same code being used in the writings of the Arizal. They're using the same code. Right? Questions, you know, that's the Moshe. What's the Nimshal? Right? Until the generation of the Ramchal, no one wrote down what we call the Nimshal, what the terms do mean. Right? It was always just put in writing use the words of the Ramchal. They wrote down only the metaphor was committed to writing. What the metaphor really means was always kept Baal Peh. No, because it was always kept Baal Peh, you know, and people only hear what they want to hear, and people only hear it the way they understand it. That's why some discrepancies crept in. Right, as to what certain terms really mean. Now, it's beyond the scope of this class to talk about the big terms that people got very confused by. And Ramchal came and he started writing, he says he's given permission from heaven, right, permission from heaven, to write the Nimshal. Right? In the form which he does it, you know, the most outstanding sefer which excels in this is his sefer called the Klach Pisei Chachma. 138, you know, entries to wisdom, where he says all the Ari wrote was the Moshel. I'm going to explain to you what those terms really mean. The Ari only was given Rishus from Shammai to write the metaphor. I will tell you what the metaphor really means. Now, who is he to do that? Okay, so now we get into his amazing but tragic life. So first, I think most people probably know the Ramchal only lived to the age of 40. Right? So when you take look at what he accomplished, it's mind-boggling. Now, obviously, as one could expect, you know, as a youngster, he was a prodigy. At the age of 16, he wrote his first sefer, right? A book about the secrets of Lashon HaKodesh. And at the age of 20, he wasn't even married yet. He had his own yeshiva, right? And all his talmidim were older than him. Some were more than twice his age. And they started learning Kabbalah from him. And he was 20 years old and unmarried. Right? Something like the age of your older brothers. Right? And people double his age, they were sitting and learning from him, you know. So, you know, they had like a sort of mysterious group going on over there. They had a very interesting code of honor and conduct within the yeshiva. Certain code words that they had, a person said a certain word, everyone had to just stand silent and be makabo omar for shemayim. I don't want to go into all the details. They had some very interesting code of honor and conduct amongst themselves. Some wild stuff. And he was only 20 at the time. Okay. So now Padua, where he lived, had the best medical schools at the time. So there was one young man, Rav Yekusiel Gordon, who came all the way from Vilna, Poland, to Padua, where Ramchal was, to study medicine. He became acquainted with the Ramchal. He dumped studying medicine and enrolled in Ramchal's yeshiva. No one knew why. But then this Rav Yekusiel Gordon, wrote a letter to one of the famous Gedolim of the time, and said, "I want to tell you what I've discovered. My Rebbe, Moshe Chaim Lutzato, is a prophet. He speaks, he regularly communicates with Eliyahu HaNavi, Neshamas of Tzadikim, the angel Matak. He goes into a trance, after a short while, he comes out of trance and writes inhumanly fast. Well, you know, it's not physically possible. Inhumanly fast, writes pages and pages of deep secrets. You know, no sefer has ever been written like these form that he's writing right now. And he's fine. I'm letting you know, that God has sent us a great gift, a great light. He didn't want me to publicize him, but I can't hold back. I just have to let Klal Yisrael know. Right? And he's writing this to a 70-year-old rabbi. I'm like, if you care about yourself, you know, and you want to excel and serve God, you'll come and learn by us, right? And you'll tell the rest of Klal Yisrael what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has done, you know, and sent us this tremendous luminary. Right? So the letter went out, started quite a work. That's big news. Right. So Ramchal was asked about it, and he said, look, I'm not going to lie. It happened. All right? When he just turned 20, the year was Tough Pei Zion. I'll go figure that out. That's 1727. Right? He had his first revelation then. He had been learning Kabbalah since a very young age, right? And he was a very holy person, right? And he had his first revelation. Angel came to him and told him whatever secret he told him, and guided him to attain higher states of purity, till he started, communicating with the all stars, the greatest people that ever lived in our history, and they would learn with him the secrets of the Torah. You have a question.
After Qurban by Shini, there is no nevuah in the world.
There's no nevuah on the same level of being able to see things like the Merkava that the Nevi'im see, but there's still something called Ruach HaKodesh. A person could have a state of augmented intelligence, and he could communicate with, you know, Neshamas of Tzadikim that have already, you know, departed, and Malachim. He won't see, you know, the Merkava, like, you know, Yechezkel, Yishayo, right? But he could have, he could have otherworldly experiences, even if it's not Nevuah in the strict sense of the word.
It's not prohibited to make communication with dead people.
No, he doesn't communicate. He doesn't go to their, he doesn't deal with their bones. The prohibition of Ov and Yidoni, right, and being Doresh Olam Meitim, is where a person tries to, you know, cling to the force that's on the dead bones, right? That God forbid, he didn't do that. But to attain a state where a person communicates with a neshama in heaven, that's mutar. He didn't go to, you know, to the energy that's on the bones. That's what's prohibited, right? I brought here for show and tell. No, these are some, you know, I'm going out of order. Right, but these books that I have in front of me over here were recently reprinted, last 10 years. They were originally burnt, right, for reasons that we'll get to. But these are the Sfarim that the Ramchal wrote, you know, based on his communications with the Neshamas of Tzadikim. You could open up any place in the book, you know. Come Avram, Sava Chasida, Pasach Vam, Rebbe, came Avram Avinu. And comes from Ramchal and calls Ramchal, Rebbe. Vam Matat, Sar Rava Asi, Pasach Vam, Rebbe, the Malach Matat, the Sar Shalom. Anyway. You open up anywhere. Right? So his Talmidim attested that this is what was going on. Right? Vorai Mehinda Ati, Father Moshe Rabbeinu came to the Ramchal. That's it. He writes down what he taught him. Right, the Ramchal is working on a whole other Zohar. Right, said Rosh Hashim Bayochai, he started. I'm going to finish. I'm sorry. Still heavy stuff going on. Right, he was only 20, and he wasn't even married yet. He was a bachur. Right. So, maybe we should have said this earlier, but I have to backtrack a little bit and understand, you know, the times that the Ramchal lived in were times of high alert, because only 20 years before the Ramchal was born, which is 40 years before the time we're talking, right? As like Shabbatai Tzvi was, So now you have to understand something else, right? To understand how Shabbatai Tzvi had tremendous success initially, right? So we know that the Ari HaKadosh, right, had these types of revelations that we speak about, and that's how we knew tremendous things that people, the generations before him, didn't know, right? How do we know he was genuine? Because he lived in Tzfat at the same time as the Beis Yosef, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, and the Beis Yosef, who was at least 30 years older than him, said he's the real thing. I believe, right? You know, the Beis Yosef says, the Shulchan Aruch says, and Shulchan was 30 years older than Yari. Right? He says, Yari's the real McCoy. I believe, I'm in, right? So the Yari and his Talmidim had these types of experiences, right? And everyone went wild, right? Because the revelation, you know, not just from the phenomenon, but the tremendous depth that there is in the Torah of the Yari, you know, it fired the imagination of all Klal Yisrael for the next 100 years. Initially it was like forbidden fruit, which only caused people to become more thirsty for it. Originally there was a cherem that you're not allowed to teach the Torah of the Ari in Chutz Lars. They kept it, you know, within Eretz Yisrael. Right? Right. It's one of the first sources for, you know, the life and times of the Ari was a letter written by this word Shlumiel. He was someone from, you know, he's a European, right? And he was a big fan of Kabbalah, right? And he lived right after the Ari had passed, right? And one of the Gedolei Hador at that time was the Rama Mipanur, Nachem Azariah Defano, right? Lived in Italy, one of the Gedolei Hador, right? And you know, sort of, like we said, there was a cherem, you know, not to let the Torah of the Ari into Chutz Lars, because they're afraid it would be misused. Right? But the Ramami Pano is the Gadol Ador. You can make an exception for the Gadol Ador, right? And they sent him the Torah of the Ari. And he wrote that, you know, I learned Kabbalah my whole life, and there's been nothing like this. So they'll show that the Gadol Ador says that everything that he learned until that day was like nothing compared to Torah of the Ari. Amen. So he divorced his wife because she wasn't going to follow him to Israel. He's got to have that Torah. Said, here, you take everything, you take the car, you take the house, I'm out. Right? And he went. He moved to Eretz Yisrael, you know, to get the Torah of the Ari, because that's the only way to get it. Right? And he was the original source of all the stories of the Ari. He sent letters to the Gedolim and Chutzlard that it's amazing where I'm being exposed to over here, and you think you know Kabbalah. It's like nothing compared to what the Ari revealed. And that was a type of, you know, tremendous excitement there was around the Torah of the Ari. But as exciting as this, it's even more abstruse, you know, abstract. The Torah of the Ari is, you know, is impossible to understand to the uninitiated, and even when you first start, you have to be working closely with a Rebbe who has a Mesorah on what the terms really mean. Right? Well, people were wild about the Torah of the Ari, right? And, you know, and also the circumstances behind its revelation. So Shabbatai Tzvi doesn't come too long after that, right? And he says, everything I say is based on the Ari. And no one knows Ari well enough to argue with him. No one knows much about the Torah of the Ari at all yet in Chutz Lars. I don't know, it's already made its way around Chutz Lars, but still, you know, that's how Shabbatai Tzvi, you know, had meteoric success. His meteoric rise was because he said, you know, everything I say is based on the Ari, and he would quote from Ari right, left, and when he would say something, you know, silly, right? So he had someone who was the scholar of the movement. Natan HaAzaki, right? Nathan of Gaza. Yeah, right here. Yeah. Over the Green Line. Right? So this guy was the big scholar of the movement. Shabbatai Tzvi would say something silly. So Natan would show you how it's the most brilliant thing one could ever think of. Because look at this half quote from the Ari. Look at that other half quote of the Ari. Put them together. That's really what Shabbatai was doing or saying. Right? Now this Natan himself, he was the big thinker of the movement. He didn't have the appeal to be Mashiach, he's somewhat of a geek, but he had the right appeal to be the scholar of the movement. So Shabbatai Tzvi, he would give the address, right? He'd say strange things. Sometimes he would sing in the middle of his talks. You don't want to read songs. The man was mad, right? But then comes Natan after the address and explains to you how these were very, very deep things you just saw. And this Natan knew Zohar and Ari Baal Peh. He knew it cold. Right? And he himself also used to go into some type of trance, right? You know, go there, and then wake up half an hour later and start giving amazing discourse, brilliant discourse, you know, explaining Ari, explaining what Shabbatai did, putting them together. You know, a genius he was. Right? Gedolim said that they don't know Zohar as well as Natan from Gaza. Right? But then the whole thing ended up to be a big fraud. Right? The whole thing came up to, you know, how are we so certain? Because we know Shabbatai Tzvi converted to Islam. Right? So that's a no-brainer, right? He's not Mashiach. Right? So after that, Klai Yisrael went on high alert. And people start talking, you know, I've got new pshatim in Ari, and I can explain to you difficult passages, and how do I know? Well, you know, I have, my intelligence is augmented supernaturally. Uh-oh. You know, that sounds like nothing. Right? But the truth is, it kept on going, because when Shabbatai Tzvi converted to Islam, there are people that still believe him for another 200 years. So relatively recent history, there are still Jewish cults that believed that Shabbatai Tzvi was Mashiach. And they had certain books that were based on the writings of Natan from Gaza, right, where they explained how it's possible, I'll pick Kabbalah, that Mashiach will convert to Islam to raise certain divine spots down there, and stuff like that. Right? In the generation of the Ramchal, there was a guy, you know, the Ramchal, think he died when Ram Chaya was a little kid, right? But, you know, but the eldest generation remembered a guy by the name of Nehemiah Chevan, who continued to write books about Shabbatai Tzvi, continued the line of thought of, you know, that are lined out in Natan Sparim, right? And also, you know, he was smart enough to get Haskamis on his farm from certain Gdol. He walked in, he showed that he knew, right? He worked with the Gdol and he got Haskamis for his farm. Then he said, you know, he only showed him certain parts. Half of his farm were prints, right? They saw it, and therefore Shabbatai Tzvi is Mashiach and all that type of stuff. Then all the Gdol went out against him. But this Natan was running around, you know, in Ram, you know, just 20 years earlier. Right? So you understand that Christ was in a very high alert of this type of thing. This sounded just like the same, you know, the pattern matched Nehemiah Chevan, Natan Azati, Shabbatai Tzvi. Right? In short, too good to be true. Too good to be true. A 20-year-old bacher, right, is having these type of revelations. Can't be. And it sounds just like him and him. Okay. So what happened after that, you know, the Rabbonim that were particularly involved in chasing Nehemiah Chevan were the elders of the generation, right? And it sounded just like the pattern matched, right? So they decided they have to take the Ram Chaya down, right? And they thought it would be no problem. It's the eldest generation against a 20-year-old kid, right? Piece of cake. The Ram Chaya is made of sterner stuff, right? Initially, Ram Chaya answered the elders with respect, you know, and he sent them, you know, pieces of his Torah. They were unconvinced. The Ram Chaya's own Rebbe, Rabbi Shayo Basan, attested that, you know, I raised him and I know he's the real thing. It didn't help. Right? People thought Matan of Gaza was the real thing. Nehemiah Chevan got a haskam from his storm from Naftali HaKohen, the Rav of Frankfurt. Yeah. Doesn't prove anything. People could be fooled. Right? So, no one's being convinced. But then Ram Chaya wrote a letter to Rav Moshe Chagiz. Right? His patience broke, you know. Right? And he said, look, you know, you have all Kleisel behind you because you're one of the elders of the generation. I've got a Kurdish Baruch Hu and the whole yeshiva Shomala behind me. Let's go. Wait, that type of tone. No? Well, we'll see who wins. He was sure, you know. He was sure his experiences are genuine. He's being sent by a Kurdish Baruch Hu to reveal these new clarities. And of course, understand what type of response that letter got. Chutzpah. Right? A 20-year-old kid is talking to Moshe Chagiz like this. It wasn't written in low language. It was written in a very specific way, but that was the basic message. The pressure got too much. And the year Tuf Tzadi, right, Tuf Tzadi is 1730, right? To make shalom, because the Jewish people were being split, you know, over this issue, over the Moshe Chaim Tzadi. Kleisel was in uproar over a 21-year-old. Can you imagine? 23-year-old. Can you imagine? Right? Right, so the Ramchal's Rebbe made him sign a commitment in writing. He's not writing any more books based on what he's being taught from the Neshamas. Right, these things are now going to be locked up. Right, the Rabbi Shayo Basan, his Rebbe, has the key. Right, we're stopping. We're stopping. Right? And but he put the Ramchal clearly inserted in the contract so long as he's in chutz la'aretz. Right, he left himself an out clause. If he moves there to Saul, he could resume, but so long as he's in chutz la'aretz, right, he's not doing any of this anymore. Right? But what he said was he's not writing any more sforim based on what he's taught. He didn't say he was going to close his yeshiva. Right? He didn't say he was not going to learn his teachings with his Talmidim. He didn't say he wouldn't print any books. Right? It's at this point in time that the Ramchal turned towards writing non-Kabbalah sforim. Interestingly enough, his, as it were, easier sforim were written later in life than his harder sforim. At the age of 20, he was writing the hardcore stuff, right? After that, he starts turning to writing the Derech Hashem, the Das Tvunas, the Mesillas Yesharim. He wrote early Sfarim when he was under oath that he can't write Kabbalah Sfarim anymore, which means that the heavy stuff that we have from Ramchal was all written when he was 20, 21. These are things that he wrote in his 30s, you know, the Mesillas Yesharim, when he was under oath. He's not allowed to write Kabbalah. Okay. Then what happened was he went to Venice, because that's where the big printing press was. He had Sfarim to print that weren't, you know, this type of hardcore stuff. The Rabbanim of Venice were, incited by certain people that, you know, wanted the Ramchal taken down. And they said, he's breaking the promise. He's still learning with his yeshiva, right? He's coming to print a book. He said he's not going to print any books anymore, even though that book they was printing was something else. It wasn't this stuff. Right? But he's supposed to be closed down totally. Right? So they decided to rub on him of Venice, you know, to give him a different promise. What you signed with your Rebbe, that's not good enough. We want you out of the business totally. You've got to close your yeshiva. You have to print nothing. He said, look, I'm not from Venice. I'm from Padua. So the Rabbanim of Padua have authority over me. The Rabbanim of Venice don't. So they took it as chutzpah. Again, he's only 23, and he's the elders of Venice. You know, so that's when it just moved up. The opposition moved up a whole nother level. Right? Right? Things got very hot. That's when he felt, because now Rabbanim of Venice, that's another town in Italy. That means even on his home turf, right, close to home, it's getting hot. Before, the Rav Moshe Chagiz and Rav Yaakov Emden and others, that they lived in Germany at the time. All right, so the main people trying to take them down lived on a different country altogether. Now, the battleground is here. He felt he had to leave Italy. Okay. So, he was on his way to Amsterdam. That's where he moved to Holland. That's where he published the Mesillas Yesharim and the Derech Hashem. Much of his easier books to understand. Right. On the way, he passed through Frankfurt. I hope I'm not boring anybody. We're almost done. Right. He passed through Frankfurt. And, the halacha is when you go to a town, you greet the Rav. Right. So he walked in to Rav Yaakov HaKohen, the Rav of Frankfurt. He said, I'm Luzzatto from Padua. Luzzatto from Padua. They put him in jail, right? They locked him up. They said, you're not getting out of here until you sign a document that you're a fake and you're a phony and everything you wrote was just sheker. Like, you made the whole thing up. Now he had no choice. He could either sign or he could die. Live in captivity for the rest of his life. So he signed. What could he do? Right? But he said openly, at least according to his side of the story, he said openly, right, that, as he was signing, this is all, what I'm signing is sheker. And I'm signing under duress. Right? But of course, that didn't make it into the copies that they made and spread throughout Klal Yisrael. They made copies of, as it were, his signed confession. Right? And circulated everywhere, and even his own Rebbe, Shaul Bassan, was embarrassed. He openly admitted he was a charlatan and made the whole thing up. Right? Except his Talmidim knew it couldn't be true. Right? Because they saw him in action. They knew who he really was. Can't be. Right? And then he wrote his side of the story. But it's too late, because once the confession came out, right, who's going to believe his story? Whose side of the story? That was all under duress. So of course, his Talmidim believed in him. Right? His Rebbe believed in him. But now it just moved up a whole nother notch. And that's when they confiscated the writings from his Rebbe. I say these people locked up, in a chest in the safekeeping of his Rebbe. And thought, no, we have to burn them. Another thing happened at the same time. Right? One of the opponents of the Ramchal, he wasn't one of the heavy ones. It was from Nehemia. He was the Art Bezdin of an Italian town called Perira. Right? This Nehemia converted to Christianity. He was a diamond. He converted to Christianity while this was all happening. Right? And you say he was involved on some level with the whole Ramchal affair. And you know why he did it? Why he said he did it? Because he became convinced that Christianity is true, Al-Pi Kabbalah. Right? You have to know something which we neglected to mention. There was a big fad amongst the Christians at that time. Look, if Shabbatai Tzvi could do it, the Christians could do it also. Listen, if you take Torah but you don't know what it means, you could read anything into it. Right, so you could read things into the Zohar that, if you translate with a Hebrew-English dictionary, right, it could sound like Christianity, because if you don't know what you're talking about, you could see in it whatever you want to see in it, right? Right? And, there were books written by missionaries trying to synthesize Kabbalah with Christianity, Rachmana Litzlan. Right? It was heavy. The Ramchal writes in one of his letters, he met a countess, a shiksa, that knew Ari Baal Peh. Kabbalah is very popular amongst Christians. Because if you don't know what it means, you could see in it whatever you want. Right? So this guy was affected by that. So now what were the Ramchal's opponents afraid of? Now the guy has become a Christian. He and his whole family midday converted B'Sne'am Ve'Eda to Christianity. Right? They were afraid that he is going to tell the church authorities about these writings, and he'll tell them that these writings of Luzzatto bring proofs of Al-Pi Kabbalah for Christianity. Right? So they were afraid, that he would just bring the whole thing to the attention of the church and make things just even worse. So that's why they felt justified in confiscating by force the writings. And they were shipped off to Germany. They got lost. Right? For hundreds of years, we didn't know where these writings were. Right? In the end, the Ramchal, during his time in Amsterdam, which even though he treated him with great respect, he still had to earn. He worked as a diamond polisher to support himself. But it's during his time that he wrote his non-Kabbalah Sfarim. It was all done in Amsterdam. But he wanted to get back to Kabbalah. Right? So that's where he undertook to go to Eretz Yisrael. But shortly after he arrived in Eretz Yisrael, he died in Akko. Right? And he never made it. His opponents took it to mean, we were right. He died young. He didn't make it to 40. Right? But his own Rebbe wrote a letter and said, I'll tell you, he was a Gilgul of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's why his name was Moshe. And he continued the tikkun one step further. Moshe Rabbeinu died in Chutz La'aretz. He made it to Eretz Yisrael. Right? Not to Eretz Yisrael Mamish, because Akko has halacha of being a suffix. He made it one step further, and Mashiach will finish. He moved everything one step further. Why do we believe in Ramchal? Right? Why has history vindicated him? Right? Three reasons. Right? First of all, from a pure academic standpoint, the ones who are closest to him believed in him. Right? The ones who knew him were the ones who believed in him. The ones who didn't know him were the ones that said he's Sheker. Right? So the ones who knew him were the ones that believed in him. So who knew him better? But the real vindication comes the next generation. The Vilna Gaon said that if the Ramchal was alive, I'd go walk to him to hear what he has to say. And we know that the Vilna Gaon put on Shabbat clothes when he got the Ramchal's Pirush on the Zohar called the Adya Bamorah. The Vilna Gaon said, there's not a single extra word in the whole Mesilas Yesharim. Right? So, the Vilna Gaon was bigger than anyone, as great as the rabbis that oppressed the Ramchal were, no one was as big as the Vilna Gaon. And we know the whole yeshiva world of today are a continuation of the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. And in Chassidus, the Mezritcher Magid, the one who took over the Baal Shem Tov, also attested to the fact that the Ramchal was genuine, and the reason why he was nirdah, the reason why he was oppressed, was because he was just too big for the generation. So the generation just wasn't on the level to appreciate him. So you have to, when you're up against something you don't appreciate, you reject it. That's why, so we have it from the Messiah of the Goyim, for the Mishnadim, and from the Mezrachim, for the Hasidim. Even though there are still Hasidim that don't learn the Ramchal Torah, but not because they think it was a charlatan, God forbid, but they hold that that's not the Iker way to learn Ari. Yeah, just for on academic grounds. Now, as great as he was, it doesn't mean he has a monopoly on truth. Right? So let's say in Zidichev, or in Chabad, or in other certain Hasidim, they don't learn Ramchal, but it's because they feel that their derech to understand the Ari is better.
But,
right?
But the Ramchal, if you said, things different of the Ari?
No, they understand the Ari differently. They say, they have a different Masorah, this is what it means, right? But, you know, but after the Mezrach Maggid said he was real, right? Hasidim don't doubt it anymore. It doesn't mean that they all learn his form. Some do, some don't. Right? Okay. We'll start Mr. Sean next week, Bezos.